You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the February 2025 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part B. Here's the continuation of Girls Interrupted by Evgenia Peretz. As Simon moved into her 20s, around the time he was first beginning to groom fairs, a tragic kind of clarity came over her one day after they'd had sex in the woods near his house. I remember seeing this black snake near the tarp and just feeling this deep, deep sadness. And I realize now, I just felt so lost. Is this what love is supposed to feel like? Is this all that I deserve? I realized I was now completely stuck in this secret world with my former teacher, and I just wanted something normal in my life, like a relationship without power imbalance, something I didn't have to hide from everyone, where I didn't feel just isolated in some secret bubble with this man, and I could stop lying to everyone and to myself. Even after she tried to pull away, he monitored her from afar, demanding long emails. When she graduated from law school, an event which was live-streamed, he zoomed in on her and emailed her a video with the message, "I'm still paying attention." Now, upon sharing their stories, the women wept together, not just for what they went through with Rutledge, but for the school's inaction in protecting them. The day after the women spoke, Simon called Rutledge in what would be their last conversation. It seems he was still hoping to manipulate her into feeling sympathy for his plight. "I'm glad you and Melissa have each other now," he told her. "I'm in absolute crisis. This is an existential dilemma for me. It was my fault for losing my mind and for the way that I feel affection, the way I feel love, which is clearly so wrong." He acknowledged that Norris and Chandler knew about his actions, and he seemed to be passing on some of the blame to them. "I think the school should have let me go," he said. For Fares's part, she waited to see what Miss Halls would do with the information she'd given them. Heaton had assured her that they take these matters very seriously. A week later, Heaton sent a short letter to parents announcing Rutledge's resignation and acknowledging his 32 years of service in many roles. No mention was made as to why he was departing. It was a gut punch to Fares. With the support of her lawyers, she steadied herself, went on to the Miss Hall's alumni page, and shared her story. Simon followed 2 weeks later with her own. Alumni poured out their support to both women with messages of encouragement and statements of regret. "We all knew," wrote Okeechi Davis, class of 08. "We all heard it through the whisper channel when we were there, but it was just never confirmed. As Davis says today, we didn't have the language to describe child abuse." The dam has burst. Judging by the accounts of other Miss Hall students, Rutledge's alleged victims date back to his arrival at the school in the early 1990s. One woman, who asked not to be named, recalls how he asked her to meet him in the TV room in the basement. She remembers hugging him there and feeling his penis against her, and him touching her vulva and breast over her clothing. He'd sometimes drive her off campus, where he'd put on her seatbelt for her, touching her breast. When they were spotted upon their return to campus, she became nervous that she'd get in trouble, and told the head of school at the time, Trudy Hall, about their drives off campus. Hall, now deceased and no relation to the school's founder, told her to keep her mouth shut. Another student from that period recounts how she was virtually parentless when she arrived at Miss Hall's, and Rutledge, then a dorm parent, was the only person that actually hung out with me and asked me how I was doing. On Parents Weekend, as she watched a movie in the basement TV room, he came in, cuddled up next to her under the blankets, told her how sad it was that her father wasn't there, and then had sex with her. The next morning, she was bleeding and went to the nurse. "I just had sex with an adult," the girl, then 16, told the nurse, not wanting to get him in trouble. "We don't say things like that," replied the nurse. She gave her pads and sent her back to the dorm. Rutledge continued having sex with her, including in his own house, while she was hired to babysit his children. To call out his behavior was to risk punishment. In 1997, Norris's first year at the helm, student Lisa Fagan blurted out in her senior class meeting that Mr. Rutledge effed a fellow student. Fagan says she was thrown out for slander. Silence and silencing continued to be the order of the day throughout Norris's tenure. In 2009, student Bethany Fusini, Fares' friend, told Norris she suspected that a different teacher was involved with a different student. She says Norris promptly led an assembly about the evils of gossiping and expelled Fusini. "It was always about saving the reputation of the school when other things would happen," says a former teacher. "I remember being in a faculty meeting and being told by the head of school, 'Do not talk about this outside of this meeting. This is the school's business, and do not even talk to your spouses.'" On that spring afternoon in 2008, when Nara sat across from Fares' parents and told them how important Rutledge could be for their daughter's future, she made no mention of a letter she'd received from the parents of a recent grad. Not anyone mentioned thus far. In the letter, they informed Norris that their daughter had spent her sophomore year getting close to Rutledge, and that recently he had visited her at college, where his behavior became unmistakably inappropriate. She was not physically harmed, however. "She is very upset, and so are we." The parents added, "As we must deal with the consequences of this breach of trust, we know you will want to take the necessary steps to protect other young women and their families from this experience." According to one of the parents, Norris called them in for a meeting and focused on whether they intended to sue. They assured her they did not. Norris said she would take care of the situation, but she never followed up. Perhaps that's why Rutledge tended to speak so highly of Norris, often remarking, according to Simon, "She's always treated me so well." By 2022, Miss Halls had dressed itself up with the trappings of female empowerment. The school had a new younger head, Heaton, and a new motto, "Be Bold," which was slapped on its website and capital campaign material. Some alumni who had suspected Rutledge's misbehavior and then been moved by the hashtag MeToo movement took that motto to heart and felt the time had come to say something. Not only was Rutledge still teaching there, he had been given the Leonard Family Teaching Chair Award, which honors a faculty member who possesses the highest personal and professional ethics. At the 2022 reunion, Rutledge, red-faced and drunk, stumbled around the reception hall, according to Sushil Sinha, class of 00, a member of the alumni council. She then joined a group of women, spanning a dozen years at Miss Hall's, who were discussing the sexual relationships he'd had with their former classmates. Sinha was hearing this all for the first time and became alarmed. The following morning, Sinha reported what she'd heard to Heaton. According to Sinha, "She looked me in the eye and said, 'I want to know what's going on in my school.'" Sinha believed the matter would be dealt with. But by reunion weekend 2023, which featured guest speaker Lucia Evans, Rutledge was still working at Miss Hall's. Mary Adamsick, class of 03, who won an alumni leadership award that weekend, confronted Heaton with the same information that Sinha had a year earlier. "Are you aware of this?" Adamsick asked her. Adamsick got the impression that Heaton was hearing this for the first time. She just looked at me like a deer in the headlights and shook her head. Heaton told her it wasn't the right time to talk, but to call her at a later date. But when Adamczyk tried to reach her the following week, Heaton didn't return her call. During that same reunion, Adamczyk asked Verdon, who'd allegedly turned away Simon's whistleblower 20 years prior and who was now dean of students, why a sex abuser was still working there. According to Adamczyk, Verdon replied, "I don't see anything, I don't know anything, I don't say anything." And it doesn't seem like Rutledge was deterred all the way through the 2024 school year. Jessica Gleason, a parent of a class of 27 student, reports that Rutledge lavished attention on her daughter last year. After Gleason pulled her daughter for the following year, the school refused to return her deposit. According to a 2024 graduate, Rutledge was still testing the waters as late as last spring, with his hands lingering for too long on girls' shoulders, for example, and sitting uncomfortably close. After Fairs and Simon went public with their stories, Miss Halls made a statement acknowledging Rutledge's misconduct and notified the authorities about Rutledge. In early April, it hired a small Maine-based law firm, Alita Law, to conduct an investigation. The school declined to answer Vanity Fair's questions, citing that investigation, and provided a statement that read, in part, "We are fully committed to learning the truth about what occurred, so that we may extend support to anyone in our community who was harmed and continue our efforts to safeguard our students today and in the future. Still, members of that community feel the school has fallen short." Faculty member Robert Bolger, who shared check-in duties with Rutledge in recent years, says that he learned about what had happened from local news reports. Concerned, he went into Heaton's office to discuss it. She nervously asked him if he was investigating. Bolger resigned at the end of the school year. "Most galling to Fairs and Simon is that the school has yet to establish a therapy fund for Rutledge's survivors." This, in part, prompted Fairs in October to file a civil suit against the school and Rutledge. In October, the Berkshire County DA's office announced that it would not be filing charges, citing the age of consent in Massachusetts, which is 16. Fairs was in her bed when she read the news online. "I curled myself up into the smallest ball I could and wept. But then she got up and closed the chapter on that girl. No more feeling small," she told herself. Through her lawyers, she told the DA's office that she did not accept the decision that rape is rape. After a subsequent meeting with Fairs, the police announced that the case was ongoing. Though it's unclear whether charges will ultimately be filed, her fire is undimmed. "It's so clear to me now what I deserve, what survivors everywhere deserve, what is just and what isn't," she says. "Once you gain that kind of clarity, there's no erasing it or looking back." red hot. There's no one in Hollywood or anywhere else, probably, like Natasha Lyonne. Her wry, wrenching work and poker face, his three daughters and Russian doll, has brought an indie favorite into the spotlight by Joy Press. Photographs by Camilla Akrens, styled by Celia Azoulay. Hats off, the high-spirited Natasha Lyonne was photographed at Gary's Lofts in New York City on November 3rd. What's so amazing about having a moment is they let you do stuff, says Natasha Lyonne, her halo of orange curls bobbing in the East Village twilight. It means your ideas are worthy of bankrolling and worthy of actually getting made, and it means the freedom to not have to hustle quite so hard. You don't have to go in and open your briefcase, show your wares, and have people say, no, thank you, we're not looking for any stopwatches today. I've had decades of that. Lyonne lurked at the margins of Hollywood a long time, an eccentric with self-confessed niche appeal. But in recent years, she'd moved closer to the center, or maybe the center has finally come to her. After creating the mind-bending, Emmy-winning series Russian Doll, Lyonne scored a hit with the charming retro murder mystery series, Poker Face, and was acclaimed last fall for her moving performance in His Three Daughters. Her days are now a frantic treadmill. Appearances in the upcoming Fantastic Four movie and Taika Waititi's Clara and the Sun, producing, starring in, and directing some episodes of Poker Face's second season, and developing projects for her own production company, Animal Pictures. I've had moments in life that have been lonely and dark and broke enough where your priority is definitely not, did you pitch a TV show well this morning? So if I hear myself being like, I'm so tired, that means I've lost the gratitude for how extraordinary my circumstance is. Lyonne appeared in Pee-wee's Playhouse as a child and starred in Slums of Beverly Hills and American Pie as a young adult. Now, 45, she looks back in anger rather than nostalgia. I remember those years pretty well against my will, she says in that raspy New York accent that sounds like a wise guy crossed with a borscht belt comedian. There's something about being alert and in the workforce as a child. You can't put the genie back in the bottle. You can't unknow what you've seen. That sensation of being a commodity has informed everything she's done since. The second child of Orthodox Jewish parents, Lyonne grew up in New York and Israel against a backdrop of drinking sprees, fights, and general volatility. Her mother was an aspiring ballerina, her father a boxing promoter and a radio shock jock who, she says, did things like calling into Howard Stern's show while she was a guest. All this made them what she diplomatically calls tricky stage parents. You don't necessarily want to win at this thing that you're being told is a prize, so I was always trying to hide in the shadows. Since my parents' dream was for me to be famous, my whole purpose in life was to try to crush their dream by not doing that. Instead of getting her degree at NYU, she picked up a heroin addiction, and after she had kicked her habit, had open-heart surgery to repair the damage. After her parents died, circa Orange is the New Black, in which she played a junkie, she began to feel more comfortable being front and center as an actor. I always dreamed of this fantasy place where I was able to do the thing I loved so much, she says, but without this albatross on my back of being somebody else's funnel for cash. Now that she's arrived at this dream destination, Lyonne is reveling in her new freedom to stretch out in projects that tickle her imagination. It's like going off on this little adventure into this space that's not quite here or there. It's a third space, and we're all going to agree that it's real and live there for a while, she says. She breaks into a huge smile. I'm pretty honest about that being my kink. For Russian Doll, she and her collaborators, Amy Poehler and Leslie Headland, assembled an all-female writer's room to invent a genre. As Lyonne booms in the deep tones of a movie trailer narrator, it was quantum physics meets trauma meets comedy, her own character, Nadia, had a touch of the Philip Marlowe gumshoe about her, so it's not surprising to hear that Leon spent much of her youth in run-down New York theaters and YMCAs watching noir films. She eventually developed an internal voice that narrated everything she saw and experienced as if she were living inside a noir. I'm sure a therapist would just call it disassociating from trauma, she adds with a shrug. This dovetailed perfectly with Ryan Johnson's notion of making a Columbo-style series. While Russian Doll's Nadia was trying to unravel her own existential mystery, Pokerface's Charlie ends up traveling the country as a fugitive, helping solve strangers' murders. Charlie loves people and can't help but get herself tangled up in helping them, Leon says. The character is witty and warm, putting people at ease as she drifts through unglamorous pockets of America. Leon says Charlie belongs to a classic American lineage of drifters who just hang out on the fringes of society as a witness, which reminds me of the way she describes herself to me, as the quiet one, sort of like the witness in her own family. I was always cataloging scenes and vignettes and tableaus. I did always think I would be able to write my way out of whatever nightmare I found myself in. That death is a primary motif in Poker Face and other recent projects is not a coincidence. I am endlessly, recklessly fascinated with the fact that we die at the end of our movie, no matter what we do, she says. You could not think of a more insane outcome to this whole gig than this finality. Leon, the rare actor who name-drops philosophers and actively wants to discuss string theory, points out that despite our being steeped in futuristic technology, we're still stuck in an actual lived experience where we have no idea when it'll hit. You could just walk down the street and a brain aneurysm or a bus hits you. All the more reason to enjoy her hot streak, hopscotching between Clara, which is based on a novel by Kazuo Ishiguro, and a Marvel blockbuster. I'm very moved that they want me to be in that movie, Leon says, of Fantastic Four, adding that she's known co-star Ebon Moss-Bachrach for 25 years. Oddly enough, she sees dots connecting the movies. It is all very interstellar-type stuff, coming at it from different directions. Her eyes light up. I'm also in the Smurfs movie, she says, and actually some stuff does happen that's... I don't want to get into it because I'll get in trouble, but assuming that I'm dead by 8:45 p.m. tonight and they have to cut the movies together in a mashup, it will all marry well, I think. Leon has been so busy that success snuck up on her, but she's landed on the perfect amount of public recognition. People on the streets of New York treat her more like a good luck charm than a superstar, she says. I can get in anywhere, but also get lost anywhere. sure. Let a neighbor use the guest room for a few nights. What could go wrong? A lot, as a series of unsuspecting residents learned after one woman allegedly exploited California's tenancy laws to turn casual stays into protracted eviction wars in an exclusive Malibu enclave. The Squatter of Point Doom by Bradley Hope, Tom Wright. Opening photo shows a beautiful beach scene along the California coast. On a cool September evening in 2021, a 65-year-old artist named Alden Marin took a stroll down to the majestic beach at Point Doom to take in the sunset. The beach itself is public property, but the easiest ways to access the best parts are through private land owned by the residents of this upscale stretch of Malibu. In practice, its miles of picturesque cliffs and pristine coves are among the most exclusive preserves in California. Owning a beach key to one of the accesses is a serious status symbol. It means you're a local. You belong. On this particular evening, Alden would later tell his sister, he encountered a quirky, energetic, middle-aged woman. She had shoulder-length frizzy brown hair, piercing blue eyes, and a British accent, and she introduced herself as Ellie Mae McNulty, an actor and screenwriter. Alden, who had graduated from Stanford and attended the Sorbonne before running a successful wine business, had been battling stage 4 melanoma for the past 3 years or so. The diagnosis and subsequent chemotherapy had left him struggling with major depression and distress, so their conversation was a welcome respite from the isolation of the pandemic. He'd see McNulty a few more times over the next month, on the beach, as well as at the supermarket and other shops in town. They became friendly, and McNulty suggested they attend an art exhibition together. Then, according to Alden, about a month after their first encounter on the beach, McNulty mentioned that she was looking for a place to stay for a few days while waiting for her next residence to be finished. By the end of their chat, Alden would later recall, he had invited her to stay at his two-bedroom condominium for a few days until her new place was readied. What could go wrong? She must have a beach key or be close to someone who does, he thought. For Alden, a sensitive painter and poet, the excitement of having some companionship overcame whatever doubts he harbored. She saw in my brother a kind of perfect storm, says Alden's sister, Mindy Marin, a veteran casting director who has worked on such films as Clear and Present Danger and Thank You for Smoking. She has this actressy English thing about her, super flirty. She's just got it down, especially the men, by being this English rose. Soon, though, the mask came off, Alden and his family say. In the months ahead, they claim, McNulty would unleash a campaign of psychological terror that helped land him in a medical facility while she changed the locks. About a month after she moved in, McNulty's demeanor changed dramatically. Alden would claim, in a request for a restraining order, she began berating him and ridiculing his medical problems. Alden said she took videos on her cell phone, threatening to use them as leverage to stay longer. He found himself relegated to one room in the downstairs area of his own home, unable to access the kitchen or other areas without enduring McNulty's verbal abuse, according to his declaration. I felt alone and isolated when I was forced to retreat to my downstairs bedroom, and I felt that her comments and abuse were setting me back in my recovery, he said. In her response to the court regarding the allegations in Alden Marin's submitted declaration, McNulty said it was Alden who had pursued her on the beach and invited her to dinner at his condo. I am a single, independent woman, and Mr. Marin drove me home after I said no to going to dinner and no to going back to his condo, she wrote to the court. and she said the Marines had changed the locks on her while all her home belongings were still inside. She asked to be repaid the $468 she said it cost for a locksmith to let her back in. The fateful decision to let McNulty stay, Alden later told his sister and other family members, was a life-altering miscalculation. Mindy Marin wanted justice, but soon found out that California's tenancy laws weren't in her favor, even in what seemed to her to be an open and shut case. And as she shared her story with friends in Hollywood, Mindy soon learned that her family wasn't the first to succumb to McNulty's charms. McNulty, who, according to her LinkedIn page, had come to the United States in the 1990s to make it as an actor, was working from a playbook she'd honed over more than two decades. Mindy didn't know it yet, but she and her brother were dealing with someone with an apparently deep understanding of how to exploit California's liberal tenancy laws. A picturesque promontory jutting out into the Pacific, Point Doom isn't an obvious target for those looking to take advantage of tenancy laws. Its seclusion, breathtaking views, and proximity to studios and networks in Los Angeles have made it a magnet for Hollywood A-listers. Bob Dylan has an estate here, and Martin Sheen owns a mansion above the beach. Other celebrity residents include Julia Roberts, Sergey Brin, and Rick Rubin. It's a community of high-powered people who you'd think wouldn't be easy to take advantage of, and there are few families whose Point Doom roots go deeper than the Marins. Originally inhabited by the Chumash Native Americans, Point Doom was named after Francisco Dumetz, a Franciscan missionary who came ashore in the late 18th century. For the next two centuries, the land at Point Doom, windblown and treeless, covered with scrub, was mostly used for cattle ranching. By the 1930s, stars of Hollywood's golden age, like Barbara Stanwyck and Robert Taylor, had begun building homes in the area. The Marins' ancestors, who were in show business, settled in Malibu. As Hollywood's influence grew, so did Point Doom's reputation as a haven for the rich and famous. The area's modern-day residents are no less insular than their forebears. They prefer to keep the beauty of its coastline to themselves via the system of locked gates. Only the owners of houses on certain streets have keys to the gates, which can add millions to a property's value. See McNulty on the beach put Alden at ease. Tourists couldn't get there easily. And McNulty, then 46, seemed at first like a perfect guest. She was solicitous with Alden, making tea and sharing her passion for yoga and meditation. A couple of days of idyllic novelty turned into a week, and then 2 weeks. The excuses for why her new rental wasn't yet available started to pile up. Checking in on her brother, Mindy felt something was off right away. "Oh, she's okay," Alden told Mindy, she recalls. "She helps around here. She makes breakfast. She makes sure I'm okay." But something didn't sit right with Mindy about this new person in her brother's life. She started to dig. A brief search of Ellie Mae McNulty on the internet seemed to confirm she was a filmmaker of some kind, or at least identified as one. McNulty's social media was peppered with photos of her with well-known Hollywood players, David Lynch, Al Pacino, Jim Carrey. Amid the customary feel-good aphorisms, "impossible" is just a big word thrown around by small men, she posted about her work-in-progress screenplay, a romantic comedy, and her membership in the Screen Actors Guild. On July 3, 2021, just months before she ran into Alden on the beach, She had Instagrammed a screenshot of a New York Times review that noted her exceptional acting in an off-Broadway play, along with a photo of McNulty and others on stage. What she didn't mention was that the play in question had been staged in New York in 1998, almost a quarter of a century earlier. It all seemed a bit phony to Mindy, who was on a first-name basis with many of Hollywood's top actors, agents, and executives. She'd seen plenty of pretenders in her long career, but she was busy casting Mission Impossible, Dead Reckoning Part 1, so she put her worries aside, though not before telling her brother they could hire live-in help if he needed it, rather than rely on this discomforting stranger. "I don't like the sound of this," she said. On day 31 of her stay with Alden, Mindy says, McNulty's behavior abruptly changed. Suddenly, she started telling him what to do in his own home. A sensitive individual who avoids conflict, he started to fetch her things. She even got access to his credit cards after he left them out, according to Mindy, and apparently used them for household expenses and food for the house. He was scared, Mindy says. Since the arrangement had originated as a favor, McNulty never paid any rent, according to Mindy. Later, when they pressured her to leave, McNulty claimed she was waiting for an inheritance from her grandmother before she could pay for a new apartment rental, Mindy says. At one point, Mindy called her brother to advise him on how to extricate himself from the situation. She says McNulty forced him to turn on the speakerphone, then said to Mindy, "How dare you talk to me about that?" The problem, the Morans soon discovered, was that the law was on McNulty's side. California has long been a tenant-friendly state. State law mandates that guests who occupy a room in a house, even if they are not paying and have no contract, can be considered tenants at will. While there are no hard and fast rules governing how long it takes to establish informal tenancy, McNulty's behavior in Alden's home suggests she considered 30 days to be sufficient. Landlords in California seeking to evict unwanted guests like McNulty must go through a formal court process, which can take months. The state's laws were designed to prevent landlords from unfairly evicting renters. Reached for comment, a spokesperson for the California Department of Justice noted that not paying rent, being a nuisance, and engaging in criminal activity on the premises are all considered just cause for eviction under state law. But some tenants are exploiting California's laws for personal gain. One Airbnb guest in Los Angeles refused to vacate the premises for 570 days without paying rent, and the company now advises hosts to limit stays in California to 28 days. Hotels sometimes re-register long-staying guests to prevent them from establishing tenancy. To protect landlords from at-will tenants, rental agreements in California stipulate that guests should not stay at a property for more than 14 days in a six-month period, or for more than 7 consecutive days. But Alden had no formal contract with McNulty, and no awareness that she had become a tenant. Successful smart people get fleeced because they have no idea these laws exist, Mindy says. As Mindy learned the details of the laws, she realized she was in for a fight. Her brother's fragile state and what the family saw as McNulty's increasingly aggressive behavior emboldened her. Mindy says McNulty then began to trash the place, flushing cloth napkins down the toilet, blocking the pipes, and leaving feces in the toilet bowl in what appeared to be a show of spiteful defeat. Others have used such strategies to make landlords appear negligent. In the case of the overstaying Airbnb guest, The fight began over water damage in the bathroom that the landlord said was not there when he rented the unit, according to the Los Angeles Times. The tenant stopped paying rent and contacted the Los Angeles Department of Building and Safety, which found two code violations, including failure to obtain a permit to install a shower. A judge later ruled that the tenant could not be evicted as the unit had been improperly listed. She requested $100,000 in relocation fees from the landlord, but finally moved out after he refused, the Times reported. At the time, the Marins were not aware of how difficult and costly rental laws can be to navigate. The combination of Alden's recent battle with cancer and the turmoil at home took a toll on his health. On January 11, 2022, according to a court filing, Alden was taken by ambulance to Sherman Oaks Hospital's psychiatric unit. He was diagnosed with major depression and a possible psychotic break, which he attributed to the threatening presence and worsening conditions and abuse imposed by the respondent, causing extreme pressure on me, as I merely attempted to live in my own house. While her host was gone, McNulty allegedly changed the locks, another right afforded tenants in California. According to Mindy, McNulty ignored requests to leave the house and hand over the keys. In his court declaration, Alden said she texted his family, saying she didn't want him to return to his home and insisting she could heal him through transcendental meditation taught by her friends. She even requested $12,000 from the family as a loan to vacate the premises. She stole the place out from under him, Mindy says. In a rage, Mindy started to dig deeper. Next photo, claim to fame. On Instagram, Ellie Mae McNulty, pictured here with other actors, liked to call attention to the off-Broadway play she'd starred in back in 1998. But her acting career never took off. Searching online, Mindy pieced together a rough outline of McNulty's life history. She was born in 1975 and grew up in Oxey Hall, an area near London where Henry VIII once had a hunting lodge. Her father, a communications consultant named John McNulty, had been a director of Mensa, the British-based organization for people with high IQs, but he reportedly resigned in the mid-1990s amid a scandal over expenses. He denied wrongdoing, and no charges were filed. McNulty attended private school, where she fell in love with the theater after a trip to see The Taming of the Shrew. "Found my real home," she later wrote of the experience. "Spent the rest of my life doing my best to get back there." After high school, McNulty moved to London to pursue her dream of becoming an actor while taking a series of jobs in related fields to pay the bills. According to her LinkedIn profile, she built props and painted sets for the BBC, worked for Ridley Scott's commercial production company, and became a projectionist at a movie theater. Then, like many aspiring British actors, she tried her luck in the U.S. In 1995, she enrolled as a painting and sculpture student at the Art Students League of New York, according to her LinkedIn page, then got a foot in the door on Broadway as a production assistant with Wait Until Dark, a play remembered, if at all, for Quentin Tarantino's wooden performance. Outgoing and vivacious, McNulty got to know the right people, or so she claimed. Tarantino taught her New York slang during rehearsals, according to her LinkedIn, and a top Broadway producer hired her as a script reader, providing feedback on new plays. She also began to hone her acting skills. In 1998, she auditioned for the New Group Theater's off-Broadway production of a British play called The Fastest Clock in the Universe and landed a leading role as a streetwise 17-year-old Londoner. According to one person involved in the production, McNulty struggled during rehearsals and clashed with the female director. She spent several hundred dollars on a pair of shoes to wear on stage, according to the person involved in the production, then burst into tears when she was told that the company didn't have the money to pay for such expenses. But she was cute and sexy, the person said, and with coaching, was able to pull off the role. Reviewing the show for the New York Times, critic Peter Marks called McNulty a real find and said she possessed a wild cackle that pitches upward into the range of dog hearing and the kind of pluck that helps explain why the British triumphed in two world wars. Her career, he wrote, is no doubt in ascendance. My dream came true, she later wrote, working New York City actor. After the Times review, Sam Cohn, one of the city's top talent agents, took McNulty to Michael's, the Midtown Power Lunch spot, and signed her up, said the person involved in the performance. He said I was going to be a great artist, McNulty wrote on Instagram in January 2024. McNulty said Cohn set her up with an audition for the female lead, opposite Nicolas Cage in Martin Scorsese's next film, Bringing Out the Dead. At the audition, Ellen Lewis, Scorsese's longtime casting director, asked how, with so little experience, she'd managed to secure Cohn as her agent, McNulty wrote in the Instagram post. Before she even let me read, do my work, I was intimidated and simply said quietly he came to see me in my first lead role in a play with a new group. In the end, the role in Bringing Out the Dead went to Patricia Arquette. Today, McNulty regularly tags on social media people involved in that theater performance from more than 20 years ago, a reminder, perhaps, of the path her life could have taken. Instead, Cohn soon dropped her, says the person involved in the performance. McNulty got a job reviewing screenplays for Ben Barinholtz, a Hollywood producer, according to her resume, and continued to audition for acting parts. In 2003, she landed a minor role in The Suite Life, a low-budget film about a bartender who falls in love with two brothers. From there, things seemed to unravel. She married a British fashion designer based in New York, but soon divorced him. She held down jobs for only a year at a time, according to her LinkedIn page. The film failed to propel her acting career. And so, in 2004, she headed to Los Angeles, still hoping to break into show business. Now on the cusp of her 30s, her new dream apparently was to make it not as an actor, but as a screenwriter. It's unclear when McNulty began actively trying to exploit California's tenancy laws for her own benefit. Shortly after arriving in L.A., she answered an ad for a room to rent. Two young women living in an old house in mid-city were looking to sublet a spare bedroom. It was a bit of a last-minute thing, says one of the women, Polly Orchon, a film and television producer then in her 20s. According to Orchon, McNulty spent a lot of time in her room. When she did socialize with her housemates, she had a habit of bringing up her divorce. She made it out like she was this poor victim, Orchon says. Helpless me, feeble, silly, fragile me. She always used the British thing, because Americans are quite stupid when they hear a British accent, she adds. I'm like, oh, that doesn't work with me, sweetie. I lived there. From day one, according to Orchon, McNulty complained that the room didn't live up to what had been advertised. She asked them to reduce the already below-market rent, Orchon says. On Halloween night, Orchon heard the door click and a taxi pull away. McNulty had cleared out, leaving her housemates on the hook for 2 months' rent, according to Orchon. She actually was exceedingly calculating, she says. It was only a matter of a few hundred dollars. They tried to get the money from McNulty by filing a small claims lawsuit, but records show that the case was dismissed by court order. Still hoping to break into Hollywood, McNulty sought to cultivate relationships with powerful figures. She met the director David Lynch at a museum event and began practicing transcendental meditation through his foundation, according to her Instagram. But McNulty has, on occasion, oversold her career as a screenwriter and overstated her relationships with celebrities, which mostly amounted to passing encounters and photo opportunities. She claimed in one email to a landlord that Mike Medavoy, the legendary producer involved with One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and The Terminator, was paying her for a script she was writing. That was a mirage. Michael Lee Peterson, vice president of development at Medavoy's company, Phoenix Pictures, recalls taking one call from McNulty years ago, but says they had no plans to work with her. In reality, McNulty appeared to be struggling. A few years after her Halloween night disappearance, McNulty rented an extra bedroom from a writer and filmmaker named Jason Gurvitz and another roommate. At first, McNulty was sweet and seemingly innocent, Gurvitz recalls. She failed to pay the security deposit or any rent, but said a relative would be sending her the money soon. So she moved in without paying anything up front, Gurvitz says. But then it went on, and she kept avoiding us, and it became pretty obvious 2 months in that this was a scam, Gurvitz says. McNulty, he adds, would play dumb while attempting to gaslight him and his roommate. This time, there would be no sudden departure in the middle of the night. Instead, Gurvitz says she told him to his face that she wasn't going to pay or leave. "I've been here, and this is where I live now," Gurvitz recalls her saying. By this time, according to L.A. court records, McNulty had been involved in at least 4 tenancy lawsuits. Some of the lawsuits are sealed, but at least one eviction case was dismissed by the judge. The law, it seemed, was in her favor. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.